This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Though diplomacy may yet avert a war in Iraq, many believe a conflict could start as soon as next week. The U.S. military has now assembled more than 200,000 men and women in the Gulf, and as preparations continue, all of us talk about troops, soldiers, sailors, Marines, Special Ops, Air Force, but those words don't tell us a lot about who they are. How old are they on average? Are they black? White? Latino? Are these college kids or high school dropouts? And where are they from? How many were born overseas? This hour, we want to put a human face on the military machine and ask who will fight in case there is a war. Later in the program, we'll talk with two veterans who were in the spearhead of the U.S. armored assault into Iraq 12 years ago about what they experienced and about waiting for war. But first, today's U.S. military. Why did they sign up? What are their expectations? And how is it different from our fathers or our mothers or our grandfathers' army? If you're a soldier or know someone in today's military, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Kuwait City is NPR's Mike Schuster. And Mike, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Neil.
Mike, you're there. Are U.S. forces continuing to flow into Kuwait?
Yeah, I think hundreds, if not more than 1,000 a day, must be flowing into Kuwait along with their equipment. Planes keep landing, carrying troops at a number of air bases here, and ships keep arriving at many ports in Kuwait, offloading heavy equipment, helicopters, tanks, fighting vehicles, artillery pieces, that kind of thing. I think, in fact, it hasn't slowed at all, the buildup simply continues inexorably, and I think it'll probably continue even into next week, and even afterward, if there is an attack on Iraq, even afterward.
Mm. How many troops are deployed so far, not just in Kuwait, but throughout the region?
Well, my count is that's probably nearing 300,000. There's probably over 125,000 naval and Air Force personnel on ships, carriers, and air bases in the Persian Gulf and near the Persian Gulf. And I think that there is upwards of 160,000, 165,000 ground troops, both Americans and British, maybe 140,000 or more Americans, and the balance British, now deployed into the Kuwaiti desert.
And are they right up on the border next to Iraq?
I think a few are, but I don't think many are. As best as we can tell, most of them come through Camp Doha, which is just west of Kuwait City. And then they're sort of spreading into the desert. And as more come, they keep moving forward toward the border to make room for the new ones who have come. But there's still a lot of desert in between Kuwait City and the border, and there's a long border, more than 100 miles with Iraq. And I think that they're fanning out, in effect, in the desert. But I think that the military command is keeping them away from the border. I think that there are units of the U.S. military that are surveilling the border and preparing the border area to move through. But I don't think there are large deployments of troops close to the border at this point.
A lot of people say, whether it was before D-Day or before the ground assault in Desert Storm, waiting for war is the hardest part. Any idea of what they're doing?
Well, I don't think that there's much waiting, and I don't think there's much idleness. Because this buildup had to occur so quickly, and because the bulk of the troops and their equipment have come in just the last month, I think that they're all very, very busy. A lot of troops take the equipment off of the transport ships that bring in here and prepare it to be moved to staging grounds where they'll be able to attack Iraq. And those that are now out in the desert, the 3rd Infantry Division, for instance, has been out in the desert for a few months. They do a lot of training. They do a lot of training for desert warfare, and they do a lot of training and preparation of their weapons. And then sometimes they're hit, like last week, with bad weather, a severe rain and sandstorm, and they got to do it all over again, make sure that their weapons haven't been degraded by the sand and the winds and the rain. So I think that they've been very busy in this short build-up period.
This is the rainy season in that part of the world. You don't think of the Kuwaiti desert and rain in the same breath, but it can also be cold. But you've been talking to soldiers there. What's the mood like?
I think the mood is they all try to be very upbeat. They have moved many from the United States, some from Europe, in a very short time. It must be bewildering in some respects. But I think that their commanders have them focused on the jobs that they're going to have to perform should there be an invasion of Iraq. And you get the feeling, at least when you talk to troops, they all exhibit an upbeat, we're ready kind of feeling. I think every soldier must worry about the unknowns of war once the invasion starts. But there's not a great deal of overt talk about the dangers of war, just the job that they need to do, and they seem to be very much focused on it.
Thanks very much, Mike. I know it's late there, and we appreciate you staying up to talk with us.
Well, it's always good to be with you, Neil.
Okay. NPR's Mike Schuster speaking with us from Kuwait City. Joining us now here in Studio 3A to give us a sense of who today's soldier is Charlie Moskus. He's a military sociologist at Northwestern University, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Can you give us a picture of those soldiers that Mike Schuster was talking about? Who are they?
Well, the soldiers today in Kuwait and getting ready to perhaps go to war in Iraq are basically working class and lower middle class young men and women. They are not the bottom of society by any means. They are likely to be higher minority than the general population, but not particularly heavily concentrated in the combat arms. The most notable thing is that America's elite or privileged youth are not in the military today. A recent study was done on Congress. Out of 435 congressmen and 100 senators, only four had children in the military, and only one is an enlisted person. I mean, listen to Mike, too. I was in the Gulf War, and it's just like deja vu all over again. Mm-hmm. Most of the troops there really wanted to go home, get this war going so we could get out of here and go back home. So it's the absence of the elite. That's probably what we've lost in the last 30 to 40 years. You mentioned earlier, too, Neil, about what do their fathers think, who might have been veterans. That's another difference. Most of these don't have fathers who are veterans. Today, it'd be grandfathers. We haven't had a draft effectively since the early 1970s, so you're talking a 30-year gap now,
right,
between conscription. So this has been an all-volunteer force for over a generation.
With an all-volunteer force, is the average age older than it was when there was a draft army?
Actually, it's about the same, but the difference is, if there's a big sociological difference between the draft army and the and today's all-volunteer army, is the high number of married junior enlisted people. In military terms, if you look at something like corporal or specialist in army terminology, there are as many married people at that level, which is a lower enlisted level, as there are first lieutenants. In the old days, the expression was that the army wanted to have you a wife, it would have issued you one. In a manner of speaking, they may be doing that now. But that's, I think, one of the big differences sociologically between this current army and is the highly married junior force. Another factor is when people are joining, they do join for a variety of motives. Some want it because it was a job. Some want the excitement. Patriotism is certainly always an underlying element. But a very big attraction today is the educational benefits, the GI Bill. The big competition for recruiters today is not the economy, but it's college. Two out of three high school graduates today goes on to college, and virtually every Army person is at least a high school graduate. And that's where the competition comes from, and people are sort of, weighing those kinds of alternatives.
And that might be a reason why the sons and daughters of congressmen are not in the military. They may be off in college or starting their careers.
Well, if I can just give a personal anecdote, I graduated from Princeton in 1956. Out of 750 males, 450 served. Last year at Princeton, with a class of 1,000, male and female, only three served. So you can see the change in the class background.
Obviously, the presence of women is a major change as well. Many more women today and in many more roles than there used to be.
Certainly during the draft era from Vietnam and before, the number of women was 1% or 2%. And indeed, there was a special women's corps in each of the services. Today, females make up approximately 15% of the armed forces. Of course, they aren't in ground combat roles. But this is a big difference. If they're not in ground combat roles, they're even larger than in the support positions. So you can go to a place like Kuwait, I'm sure, And if you look at the logistics space, it's probably 20 to 25% female.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. Our first caller is Anne, who's on the line with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the show and for taking my call.
Sure.
Our daughter is a college graduate and had a very successful career going as a web designer, but decided her window was closing on an interest to be in the military, and so she joined at 30. And she's in the Navy now as a sonar technician and enjoying the studies of technology and science in a way that we were rather surprised and delighted at. But, of course, the talk of war is very worrying.
Sure. Is yours a military family?
No. Not directly. My husband served in Vietnam and uncles, and my father was in World War I in Italy. And so there is some military background, but not a military family in that there were career military.
But there was a lot of tradition, it sounds like.
Yes, indeed.
Do you know, can you tell us where she's based?
Norfolk.
In Norfolk, Virginia. So she's...
Correct.
Her ship has not been sent over, or at least not yet.
Not yet. Mm-hmm. Not yet, but we expect deployment about June.
Well, all we can do is... Are you able to stay in touch with her if she's certainly based here with email, phone calls?
Right. That's a wonderful thing to have today, that we can be in touch by email. Right. Can't say very much, but at least we can hear her voice and talk family things. But it is, we're very proud of her, I need to say, and that this is a choice she made, but it certainly wasn't for college, for the GI Bill. It was simply, I guess, a combination of her own patriotism and interest in the military that went back to her teenage years.
And is she finding, you talked about the technology, is it challenging? Is it interesting work?
Oh, it's very exciting for her. She's loving it. She's loving the oceanography and the science of sonar and so forth. So that's... I don't know whether her art background actually prepared her better for this in a way that she sees the larger picture instead of the details and can fit things in a very composite way. But that's what we tend to get from her, and that's what we feel we understand from her.
Well, Anne, thanks very much for the call. And you may want to tune in tomorrow. We're doing a show about military families tomorrow, so you may want to call in on that one as well. But
great. Thank you so much for your show.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
And Charlie Moskos, that's, according to what you were talking about, that's it takes all kinds.
It takes all kinds, and it's a very heartening story. It's an exceptional story, though. As a matter of fact, recruiters are telling me that with the buildup in the war in Iraq, their parents, especially, are now discouraging their children from enlisting into the military. So we don't know how this is going to finally play out.
A couple of years ago, when the economy was going strong, there was so much competition for young men and women, the armed forces were having difficulty making their recruiting goals. What's it like now?
They're making their goals today, but it's getting tougher, and we don't know what this... And apparently the word on the street is that the buildup in the war in Iraq is hurting recruitment in the last several weeks. It's interesting, Ann mentioned about email. We did a study in Kosovo, and it was 80% of the troops there were using email at least once a week or more. So that is a new situation.
Different from the old V-mail from World War II,
right.
Quite a bit. We're talking about who makes up our fighting forces and what it means to be a soldier in today's military, and we'll take more of your calls after we come back from a short break. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and you can send us email anytime. Our address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the show, military families deal with frequent moves and long separations. Now, They face a country divided over the war their loved ones may fight. We'll hear their stories tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about those who will be on the front lines or back at the bases manning the computer keyboards or driving the trucks in between if the nation does go to war. Our guest is Charlie Moskos, who's a military sociologist at Northwestern University. If you're in the military or used to be, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Mark Lewis, a research associate at the Institute for Defense Analysis, a former Army captain, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Just because you're in the military doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see combat. In fact, the ratio between those who are in the front line and those who are not is pretty large, isn't it?
That's right. It looks like about 17% of DOD, all the soldiers are in gun crews or tank crews, or they're on the line, and the remainder, 80%, is in the tail. But that doesn't mean that those 80% aren't in danger, especially with long-range weapons these days.
Sure. And Charlie Moskos, so we have to include, as we talk about the people who are in the armed forces, beyond those who are in the regular forces, an awful lot of people in the Guard and Reserves have been called up.
This is a very important development, is the calling up of the reserves components in the National Guard, as occurred, you know, in the Gulf War, too. But this time the force is much smaller than it was back in the Gulf War I days, and therefore the strains on the reserves in the National Guard are really a very, very heavy. It's also the fact that many disproportionate number of reserve and guard people are firemen and police officers. And therefore, in the event of some catastrophe back in the States, we're going to be understaffed. There was just a recent article in today's paper I saw that one-third of all American cities now say that they are of their police and fire departments are hurting because of this reserve call-up. It's because, I think, largely that we don't have enough people on the active duty force, and that's why these reservists are being called up in this great percentage today.
Mark Lewis, a lot of people in the active duty force, though, people on aircraft carriers or in MPs or various other specialties, they're finding they're spending more and more time overseas as well.
Sure. The active duty force is working a lot, and a lot of the skills we need today are in the reserve force, and that's why we're seeing them come up and come excuse me, get called up a lot. It's because that there's this disconnect between what they need and what they've got on active duty.
Now, you came up through the ranks, as I understand it.
That's right. I spent 3 years as an enlisted soldier right out of high school, and then got out, went to college, and back in as an officer, spent another 8 there.
Why did you go in the first place? Why did you leave, and why did you come back?
Well, honestly, I went in in the first place because I grew up around here in McLean, Virginia. It's a pretty nice neighborhood, and went through the college competition process, and I had to spend an awful lot of time telling people why they ought to accept me into their college.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the Career Center one day at school, and there was a recruiter, and he spent a lot of time telling me why he wanted me to come join the Army.
Something you hadn't heard too much of.
That's right. Yeah.
Then you were in the Army and left to go to college, presumably.
That's right. I went in. My intention was to do a 3-year enlistment. I had a very specific job I wanted to do in a very specific unit, and the Army was able to accommodate me. And once I finished my 3 years, I wanted to go to college. But when I was in college, I decided that, hey, you know, I really missed being a soldier, and I wanted to go back.
Charlie Moskos, are there a lot of people like Mark in the military?
Not that many, actually. Though Mark is obviously was a fine soldier, but as a former draftee myself, speaking about that pre-Vietnam era when a large number of college graduates did serve, Mark, of course, received his college education after enlisting and then went on to his officer commission. There would be one other variable here, too. It would be interesting to ask Mark and others in the listening audience. You know, this is the first war in memory in which an anti-war movement started before the shooting started. And that is another new variable. I wonder how that's going to affect recruitment. It didn't happen in Vietnam. It didn't happen in Korea. It obviously didn't happen in World War II.
Well, there was the America First movement before World War II. We keep forgetting about that.
It was an isolationist movement, yes. Sort of an anti-war movement in the sense that we are having today before the shooting starts. You know, it took Vietnam 4 or 5 years before it cranked up into a genuine anti-war movement.
Well, Mark, what do you think?
It's tough to say how national politics affects the decision-making process of a 16- or 17-year-old. are they paying attention? I don't know. I certainly paid attention to, for example, the Iranian hostage crisis. That was something that happened to me when I was very young, and it solidified my desire to go and try and do something about it. But whether or not anti-war sentiment is impacting the decisions of young people, it's hard to say.
Well, let's hear some from some listeners. Maybe we'll ask them. Our next caller is Laurel, who's on the line with us from Sacramento.
Hi.
Hi.
I called because one of the things that's come up is, why aren't the elite joining up? I'm thinking this has got to be just part of the microcosm of our society. Responsibility. Taking responsibility for your own actions. Taking responsibility for the security of your society. And it just doesn't seem to be a real popular move nowadays.
We ought to describe them as maybe the educational or the financial elite, because there are certainly a lot of elite people who would not be in that category.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Laurel, are you in the military?
I'm currently in the reserves. I joined active and went on active duty in 1977. I was an officer. And in part, I think I went in because of my response to Vietnam and not having gone myself, not having been put on the line because of the draft, because women weren't being drafted at that time. And I had a real good time, stayed for 10 years on active duty, and went into the reserves, where I remain to this very day, mentoring and a number of young men and women as I've come up the ranks.
If you're in the reserves, can you tell us about some of the displacement that you might have experienced, having to leave your job at a moment's notice?
Fortunately, or not so, as the case may be, I haven't actually been placed in that situation. During Gulf War I, I was in law school. Several of the people I was going through law school with at that point were called up and did need to go. The unit I was in at the time simply wasn't called. At this point, I'm senior enough that I'm in what they call a volunteer training unit. And because of that, they're not calling us either. But the last group of people I had under my command, a logistics unit out of the Puget Sound area, have been put on pretty much a 48-hour standby. And I know it's simply disconcerting. Nobody that I've talked to has any problem at all with going, if called. But they're being told, we don't want you right now, but we may need you in 2 days. And 2 days go by, and we may need you in another 2 days. Just put everything on hold and be ready to go with 2 days' notice. It's a little bit crazy. And referring back to something that I was hearing earlier, I think in a large part this is because we don't have enough people on active duty. We don't have enough people on active duty with the right skills. We simply don't have enough people on active duty to do the number of jobs that are being asked of us right now.
Mark Lewis?
Yes, well, it's interesting. There's no question, of course, that economics plays into the range of choices a young person has, and if they can afford to go on to school, and that's a reasonable decision or a reasonable choice, they might choose to look away from the military. I mean, there's something to be said, of course, for the service ethic. But on the other hand, if you look at ROTC, for example, and you look at who's doing the ROTC programs, I think you'll find that the top universities, the top schools, are represented at a greater proportion than the rest of the population. It's counterintuitive because we hear that Harvard doesn't have an ROTC on campus or that Yale and Princeton are having trouble. But as a proportion of college-age of people and the proportion of ROTC commissionees, it's actually that the top 10 universities are overrepresented, speaking just of, by the numbers and the proportions involved.
Laurel,
well, can I say something too? I think Laurel hit a very important point about nothing's really, I call it patriotism light. She says she's disappointed that there hasn't been any kind of truly rallying in terms of actual service from people. Here we have a situation since September 11th that even our commander-in-chief has not asked people to join the military. I mean, is being patriotic, putting a flag on your SUV? This is the kind of thing I think Laurel was, hinting at.
Laurel?
I'm I don't fly a flag on the back of my car. I tend to think that I'm doing what needs to be done, and patriotism light is, I don't want to put down the people who are displaying that kind of patriotism. It worries me to a certain extent that it takes something like 9/11 to get people to display it. And how many of them are simply going along with a message that's popular to display right now is something else I question.
Well, Laurel, hang in there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Here's an email we got from Lynn Stubb. My husband, she writes, is a major in the Army. He's been either active or in the reserves for 20-plus years. His civilian life includes being a father to our two children and working for the state of Wisconsin as a 4-H youth development educator for our rural Wisconsin county. He was in the reserves. His unit was activated at the end of January. He's currently in the sandbox. By that, of course, she means Kuwait. We sometimes forget that not all of these soldiers are young. Some of them are even grandparents. And another email we got from Joseph Gallucci. Dear Talk of the Nation, I wanted to get to Carlos's email first. Carlos in San Diego wrote, do you have an estimate of how many Latins, Asians, and blacks are serving in the military these days? From listening to this show and the networks, I get the impression it's an all Anglo-Saxon military. Charlie Moskos?
Well, it varies from service to service. If you take the Army, the largest of the four services, it's approximately 8% Hispanic, at about 22-23% black, 2-3% other minority, and the remainder, of course, being white. That is the case because of the economy. The Hispanic percentage, presumably that email writer is of Hispanic background, isn't as high as it could be because of the high school diploma graduation requirement. For practical purposes, you have to be a high school diploma person to be able to enter today's military. And the Hispanic percentage of that is not as high as it could be. Mm-hmm. So that's the story. But it's not just a matter of racial or ethnic background. It's a matter of class background, too. This is what we don't have, and some of the callers have referred to this. You know, you're not really having that upper class.
I think that's right. I think it's a representation of economics more than race. And if you drew the circles around what socioeconomic background, it also would fall in on racial demographics as well.
And now that Joseph Gallucci email, I was wondering if you can ask your guest about how recruiting was affected by September the 11th. Was there a big increase? Can you also, time permitting, comment about Pat Tillman, who recently joined the military and gave up a lucrative pro football contract with the Arizona Cardinals to do so? So far as I know, the only prominent professional athlete to do so.
Well, it's interesting that he raised that. The recruiters have said that there has not been no change. Plus or minus since September 11th, except for maybe the most recent months where it made me minus because of the Iraq War buildup. Pat Tillman was a notable exception, but he's not a household word. I give the counterexample of my era when I was a draftee. Elvis Presley was a draftee. We never saw him, but we knew he was 90 kilometers down the road in Germany, and that did make an impression. If Eminem, you know, would join today's military, that would be the significant breakthrough.
We're talking with Charlie Moskos and Mark Lewis about today's military, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Stephen, who's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to sort of add to the discussion by saying that, you know, I'm an Army reservist, have been since shortly after September 11th, when I, you know, decided basically to sort of give something back to my country, or attempt to give something back to my country by going into the military. And, you know, I think it's been a great experience for me. I come out of a, you know, very professional job. And I guess what I wanted to say is that, you know, I think there are a good proportion of the quote-unquote elites that are willing to do their time to sort of protect the way of life that we have in this country.
So tell us more about when and why you decided to enlist.
Well, I think it was about a month after September 11th, and I decided to enlist because I felt like it was very important for me to be able to give something back to my country. I benefited from a state school education here in Massachusetts, and it was really sort of a personal decision that I felt like it was really important to be able to give something back, in addition to my economic contributions to the society.
Hmm. And if you're in Boston, apparently you've not been called up? You've not been
yet.
Activated?
Not yet. We're still waiting. Everybody's got their fingers crossed here. We're trying to figure out whether or not we'll be going or not. They're talking about potentially sending us somewhere else other than the Middle East to do a rotation for a group that's currently in Bosnia. So we'll see.
Now, you signed up in the aftermath of 9/11.
Yes.
Would the situation today, with the prospect of a war in Iraq, would that have changed your thinking?
No, it would not have. No, it would not have. I think, you know, this was something that I was motivated to do, and I feel I grow prouder and prouder of my military service every day, knowing that, you know, there are a group of my, you know, sort of fellow soldiers out there helping to secure American interests and make things safe for us. And I'm proud to be a part of that fraternity.
Stephen, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate Bye-bye. It. Mark Lewis, he mentioned rotating possibly to Bosnia. We forget, in addition to the buildup in the Gulf, there are forces not only in Bosnia, but in South Korea on the border there, still in Germany, and many other places around the world. The U.S. military is stretched.
Sure. I mean, we've got people in Bosnia across all the Balkans, Kosovo as well. We've got real deterrent problems in Korea. And these are the kind of things that you've got to measure and weigh how you allocate your forces across the whole spectrum of competing requirements. It's wearing people out in many ways.
And what briefly would you recommend be done to alleviate that situation? Now, we heard maybe just making the active forces bigger. Is that a solution?
Well, that's one solution, but I think that there's also the services have to take a hard look at themselves and figure out if they're managing their people properly. You know, in any given time, there's about 60,000 soldiers in the Army that are out of pocket. They're moving from one post to another. They're in school systems. They're in medical care. And if the Army got a handle on that and organized themselves properly, if they did away with some of the professions in the military that aren't necessarily military related, like the finance corps, for example. You know, if they privatized that or civilianized that, that would free up uniform slots to put in the places where they need the people the most. So that's the first step before they go seeing about increasing end strength.
I would say, by the way, though,
We're going to have to hear more about that after the break, Charlie. We're talking with Charlie Moskos, a military sociologist, and Mark Lewis at the Institute for Defense Analysis. More with them and more of your calls when we come back. We're also going to hear from two soldiers who were among the first to go in ground operations of Desert Storm in the last Gulf War, about what it's like waiting for war to begin. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about today's military. Our guests are Mark Lewis of the Institute for Defense Analysis and Charlie Moskos, a military sociologist at Northwestern University. Just before the break, Charlie, you were talking about what might be done to improve the situation, not just increase the size of the armed forces, but perhaps manage the way troops are handled a little bit better?
I think better management can only go so far. I think the crux of the issue, there are not enough people in the armed forces. That's what it has to come down to. And we can talk about civilian contractors, which, by the way, cost a lot of money, too. There are two options. One is bring back the draft, which is probably not politically feasible, though mm-hmm. Congressman Rangel and others have now introduced that bill. And for the first time in a generation, the draft is sort of on the back burner, but on the public agenda. I don't think it will happen, though. I think it deserves a great deal of support. More likely, I think, is the idea of having shorter-term enlistments to appeal to college students. Going to Bosnia, as Mark was saying, or Kosovo, I've surveyed students at many universities, and by and large, if they had an overseas tour that was short, they would be interested in joining, particularly if their student loans could be forgiven.
Let's get another caller in. Dan joins us from San Jose, California.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Hey, It's interesting to listen to this story and other stories about first people to a conflict or these long deployments surface ships go through, and it's always a 6 o'clock news story. I wonder if your readers could comment about the submarine service and how they're involved in these different conflicts.
Submarines, typically, I know that for the ballistic missile submarines, they're typically at sea half the time, aren't they? So those are tremendously long deployments. I know that they're very difficult and have been for any number of years. Dan, you sound like you know what you're talking about, though.
I spent 9 years on fast attacks out of Pearl Harbor.
Those are the Los Angeles-class submarines?
Yeah, we averaged about 260 days a year deployed.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and then if you figure every fourth day in port was a duty day where you had to be on board, in the course of a year you might have 60 days where you're not on the boat.
Fast attack submarines are being used in an ever wider number of missions, and of course at least one accompanies every aircraft carrier battle group wherever it goes. Absolutely vital part of the U.S. Armed Forces, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate your phone call. I guess you're not going to disagree with me on that one.
No, I like to bring attention to it because you always hear about these deployments going out, but what you don't realize is that the submarines left a week before and they're coming in a week later. And I think there's some recognition there that deserves a little pat on the back every once in a while.
Well, thanks very much, Dan. And you're out of the Navy now?
Yeah, I've been out for a couple of years.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mark, again, just wrapping up, you know, his experience is not unusual in today's military.
I think that's right. Of course, I can't speak for the submarine service. That's why they call it the silent service, I guess. It's a strange breed of cat. I'm glad it's him and not me. But everybody's working hard, you know. In Germany, they've got you're on a rotation to peacekeeping once every 18 months, probably. That's 6 months on a deployment, and it doesn't count the 3 months prior and the 3 months after that you're recovering or doing the training up for. It's an enormously fast op tempo that, you know, people don't count the Wednesdays they're not home, for example. Even if they're home on the weekends, you know, they might not be home on a Wednesday for an entire year because they're staying late in the office or staying overnight in the field coming home on the weekends. Well, it's a tough life.
Mark Lewis, a research associate at the Institute for Defense Analysis, formerly an officer in the U.S. Army and formerly an enlisted man in the U.S. Army.
That's true.
Very much for being with us. And Charlie Moskos, a military sociologist at Northwestern University, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
They were both here with us in Studio 3A. For the next few days and into next week, we have a special email challenge for you about Iraq. We want you to send us the quotes that you think best describe or capture this time in history. Yesterday, we launched this challenge with a quote from President Dwight David Eisenhower. After that, Michael George in Cleveland sent us these lines from T.S. Eliot. "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." And from a famous British politician, this: "If you're going through hell, keep going." That quote is attributed to Winston Churchill and was sent to us by David Mullen in Exton, Pennsylvania. What famous quotes are catching your attention at this moment? Email us at totn@npr.org and be sure to put quotes in the subject line.